Welcome to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson. The United Nations Food Systems Summit 2021 started Thursday in New York. Leaders held a news conference on ag issues I attended virtually and have these comments for you. It starts with the Deputy Secretary General of the United Nations.
Thank you so much, Steph. Thank you, everyone, for joining us here today to mark the beginning of our Food Systems Summit. It's been 2 years in the works. As you may have heard from the Secretary General, it couldn't have come at a more crucial moment. And put simply, our food systems are failing to deliver what we need for our people and the impact that they're having on the planet. Let's consider every day over 800 million people are hungry, or that millions of our children are starving, with nearly a third of all food that is produced lost or wasted. And this waste today is worth over $1 trillion, US dollars. And that, for me, doesn't seem to make very much economic sense, and it's what we have been speaking about through the 2 years. How do we make this work? 3 billion people can't afford a healthy diet. At the same time, 2 billion men, women, and children are overweight or obese. Our current consumption patterns are expected to generate over another trillion in diet-related health costs. Meanwhile, the recent IPCC report is yet another stark warning, informing us that our temperatures will be reaching the critical thresholds of 1.5 degrees Celsius earlier than 2030, 10 years earlier than predicted. And the way that we produce, consume, and distribute food is a key factor. It's not news that we face tremendous and interconnected challenges in our world today, but we do need to send that message of hope, and it needs to be an affirmation of our ability to work together. In this summit, we found something quite remarkable. We found that food offers us hope through the sustainable food production systems. It is possible to feed a growing population while protecting our planet. But this only can happen when we work together. Tens of thousands of people around the world joined us in this remarkable journey to arrive at this moment. We are convinced that we have generated a new momentum for the recovery from COVID that is oriented towards achieving the SDGs and a world that really is free of hunger, where healthy lives are ensured and our planet is protected. The Secretary General has issued a call to action of all of us, particularly governments. He has urged us to keep the promise we made through to 2030, which is a shared vision for the people and planet, but it's also an opportunity. Food systems hold a potential to do even more for people and planet, and a well-functioning food system can help us to prevent conflict, protect the environment, and provide health and livelihoods for all. Food systems do differ all over the world, and so there is not a uniform prescription for change, yet transformative actions are needed everywhere, building on some transformations already happening in some regions, but sometimes we need to go that step further if we are to make the necessary transitions to the goals. Talking about food is not always easy. It touches so many aspects of our cultures, our economies, and our environments, and it invokes some pretty strong feelings. Today shows what we can do to make that effort productively engage with one another. Throughout the rest of the day of the summit, we anticipate an echo of commitments announced earlier by youth, farmers, indigenous people, with statements from more than 150 member states, including more than 85 heads of state and government. I have to say this process has had the full engagement of heads of state and government around the world. They will be reaffirming their commitment to delivering on the 2030 agenda, which is why we have this summit in the first place. It is the SG's contribution to accelerating action towards the 2030 agenda, and in particular, SDG 2. I'm pleased to join with other leaders, as those are alongside me virtually. It's good to see you, gentlemen, who are stepping up to scale up action with urgency. We've heard those announcements from the US and also from many of our countries in Africa yesterday and today. One thing does remain clear, however: no single community or country, however powerful, can solve these challenges alone. We need everyone around the table. Everyone needs to be in the tent, including those that may not be putting the best behavior forward. That's the only way that we can get them to change. Transitions mean business models have to change. Transitions mean that cultures have to address what happens between their families and the community and the environment. The summit is not about privileging any particular group or perspective. It does bring everyone into the discussion, And we have spoken about the transitions that are needed if we are to have a better recovery from COVID. Today is a reminder of what we're capable of. It also encourages us to remain relentless about the efforts that we need to make. This agenda is about being demand-driven from those who produce the food until it gets to the table. More healthy, more in tune with our environment, and at the end of the day, good for all. Thank you.
Thank you very much. DSG will now turn to Tom Vilsack, the U.S. Secretary of Agriculture. Mr. Secretary, you have the floor.
Well, thank you very much. It's certainly an honor to be here today. And certainly the U.S. Is certainly in sync with the U.N. goals of leveraging the power of food systems to drive recovery from COVID and to get back on track in terms of advancing SDG 2. In the United States, we're focused on ending hunger and food, nutrition, and insecurity at home, and building back better our food systems here and abroad so that they are more sustainable, that they are more resilient and more inclusive and more equitable. We look forward to helping the world advance our common goal of reaching global food security and ending hunger. Excited about the coalitions that have been announced as part of this food summit, whether it's the School Meal Coalition, the Food Loss and Waste Coalition, the opportunity to expand and accelerate research and development under the Aim for Climate effort being advanced by the United States and the United Arab Emirates, or our Coalition for Productivity Growth, which is focused on making sure that we continue to have sustainable production, but also be able to produce more so we can meet the growing need. The United States has committed $10 billion over the next 5 years. $5 billion of it will be focused domestically on a more inclusive food system, focused on providing assistance and help to our most vulnerable citizens, women in agriculture and underserved producers, and focusing on greater resiliency in supporting local and regional supply chains and making sure that we have a system that can serve throughout major disruptions. An additional $5 billion will be committed over the next 5 years internationally, really focused on trying to achieve the goal of reducing poverty by 20% and stunting by 20%. This will focus primarily on food systems, increasing funding for food security and agricultural production, a more equity financing, political risk insurance to advance storage, processing, shipping, increased capacity in developing countries, looking for financing as well to expand nutrition access in low and middle income countries, food fortification, food loss and waste focus, as well as a gender representative and responsive agriculture. So we look forward to working collaboratively with the world community. This is an important time, and I think a pivotal time for agriculture in the U.S. and around the globe.
The summit concludes this morning. Our news brief is up next. We will be right back.
Agromiora Nursery is the premier nursery in California. Whether it's almonds, walnuts, pistachios, prunes, or olives, Agromiora has been the grower's source for over 20 years and is the home of Rootpack R Almond, Grizzly Walnut, and the North American plants UCB1 and Platinum Clonal Pistachio Rootstocks. As the worldwide leader in super high-density almonds, olives, and prunes, Agromiora can show you how to cut costs and increase yields with their super high-density rootstock Rootpack 20. For more information or to schedule a site visit, contact a representative at 530-812-3398 today. Soil fumigation is a critical step to ensure that your orchard gets off to a good start. Trichlor is a pre-plant soil fumigant and is the foundation for a successful pest management system. Targeted pathogens include soil-borne disease and nematodes. Fumigation helps to create a healthy soil environment that allows the plant's root system to flourish. For more information about Trichlor or to schedule an application, contact Trical Incorporated at 669-327-5076 or visit www.trical.com.
Soil and Crop Incorporated is your number one resource for sustainable nutrition. Growers are faced with difficult challenges, and Soil and Crop Inc. has the experience, fertilizer, and biological portfolio to dramatically increase yield and performance in your troubled orchards and fields. Contact Soil and Crop Incorporated today for a free consultation on how we can help reverse the challenges you face as a conventional or organic grower so you can increase your bottom line and become a better sustainable farmer. Contact us today at 559-564-1236 or visit our website at www.callnrg.com. Soil and Crop, putting nature to work for you.
Welcome back. Here's your news brief for today. A bill awaiting Governor Gavin Newsom's signature would provide essential workers, including farm employees, access to the state's stockpile of N95 respirators to protect them from smoke. Assembly Bill 73 by Hollister Democrat Robert Rivas was passed in the legislature after suppliers struggled to keep up with demand for respirators during California's record-setting fire season last year. Operation Lifesaver dedicates this week to help keep you safe at railroad crossings. Michael Clements shares more.
This week is Rail Safety Week, an opportunity to share information on how to be safe around railroad crossings by Operation Lifesaver and supported by American Farm Bureau. OLI Executive Director Rachel Molley says Rail Safety Week promotes their work to keep you safe at rail crossings.
Operation Lifesaver is a national nonprofit based in Washington, D.C. We have programs in 46 states as well as the District of Columbia, and we're all about educating the public on rail safety. So Rail Safety Week is one week in September where we dedicate a different theme day to Rail Safety Week. It's a culmination of our rail safety education that we do year-round.
It's important to highlight safety around rail crossings because of the many incidents that happen at them each year.
Every 3 hours, there is an incident, either a person or a vehicle is struck in the United States. And according to the Federal Railroad Administration, in 2020, just under 2,000 grade crossing incidents happened, which resulted in 198 deaths and 688 injuries. That's really too much.
Molley says farm and ranch crossings are typically private with no safety equipment, bringing additional dangers.
And approximately 15% of all crossing collisions happen at a private railroad crossing each year. So it's especially important that drivers of farm vehicles are aware. They look both ways. They don't commit to the crossing if they can't quickly clear the crossing. And we also don't want them to get stuck in their farm equipment on the railroad track.
You can request a free rail safety presentation for your organization at OLI.org. Michael Clements, Washington.
A Northern California agritourism hotspot is bouncing back after the devastating Calder Fire narrowly missed the Apple Hill region of El Dorado County. The fire, which burned all the way to the top of the Tahoe Basin, closed U.S. Highway 50 and scared off many of the thousands of tourists who pack Apple Hill starting each September. But local farms and attractions are banking on an October rebound with the smoke cleared and roads opened. Land-grant university economists recently weighed in on discussions on the nation's beef supply chain and how to make it more resilient during shock events. Rod Bain reports.
The Holcomb, Kansas beef plant fire, the COVID-19 pandemic, the cyber attack of the world's largest meat producer, all deemed black swan events for the beef industry and challenges to the nation's beef supply chain over the last 2 years. So how can the supply chain and producers adapt to become more resilient going forward? A panel of experts, including land-grant university economists, offered their thoughts before a recent House Ag Subcommittee hearing. And Purdue University's Jason Lusk says an understanding of history in the cattle market is important in crafting future supply chain flexibilities.
There are long lags and ripple effects in cattle markets. Don't overly focus on what is happening today, but make policies for the future.
Policies to address challenges such as packing capacity, increased transparency and price discovery, and expanded market opportunities for producers of all sizes. Kerry Jacobs of the University of Missouri says one way to assure small-scale livestock producer ownership will have opportunity for success is through cooperative-style models, with emphasis on the cooperation.
Concentration in the livestock industry, particularly at the processing stage, seems inevitable from an efficiency lens. Through cooperation, however, livestock producers can flip the script and participate in generating and receiving the value this efficiency creates. When at scale, producer ownership can smooth variability in producer incomes because it allows them to capture income from downstream markets that may be less volatile.
Cooperation will also play a key part in preventing future cyber attacks on segments of our nation's beef supply chain. That according to the University of Minnesota's Jennifer Vandelite. She says USDA, Homeland Security, and FBI coordination and collaboration is needed in the way of risk reduction and cybersecurity education efforts, Although
not only does managing cyber risk increase operational costs, but there are very few experts with the knowledge and experience to effectively enhance cybersecurity in the food and ag operational environment. This type of expert is often recognized as irreplaceable and sometimes are referred to as unicorns within the food industry. We need to train and field many more of them.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
National Farmers Union this week announced the Fairness for Farmers campaign as members gathered for a virtual fly-in. The effort seeks to rally Americans to urge lawmakers and the Biden administration to take concrete steps to curtail consolidation in agriculture, which NFU says negatively impacts farmers, ranchers, and consumers. NFU President Rob LaRue states, "We launched Fairness for Farmers because we have a president who is committed to taking on the challenge of fighting consolidation in agriculture." That's our news for today. Today is Friday, and that means we will highlight some of the week's best segments. That's coming up right after this.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcast, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
Hi, welcome to My Ag Life. Today we're talking with Franz Niederholzer, UCCE Farm Advisor for Colusa, Sutter, and Yuba Counties about activator spray adjuvant selection in trees and vines and matching the proper material to the job. Welcome, Franz.
Hi, Taylor. Thanks very much for having me on.
Yeah, great to have you here again. Franz, my first question for you here, activator adjuvants can have a place in tree and vine crop sprays, but matching the material to the job can be a little tricky. When might growers consider using an adjuvant in their tank mix? And, you know, how do they determine really which one to use?
Well, the easy answer is if it's on the label. So there are some labels, some products that specify a certain adjuvant material activator. It might be a pH adjustment, might be a penetrator. There's some in some labels that say don't use this particular activator or adjuvant. So that's the number one thing is if it's on the label or if it's specifically not, the label specifies not to use it, that's critical. As far as the decisions, if it's not on the label, but the label says, may be used with an adjuvant to improve efficacy, things of that nature, working with an experienced PCA who can make the recommendation, that's a really good step. That a PCA with that kind of experience has seen this product, that product combination that's being recommended across a range of applications, a lot more experience than you'd be able to develop on your own place. So that's really critical. There are a lot of materials out there, different adjuvants, different pesticide formulations, products. Having somebody who does that every day, as PCAs do, it's really good to have in your court to help you make the right decision.
I'm curious, in the instance where a grower maybe is thinking about using an adjuvant that is not listed on the label, but it's not necessarily listed to not used, what do they do there?
Well, it depends upon the job. If you're putting on a cover spray, you want something that's going to not penetrate into the tissue so much, but be more of a spreader. If you have something that is a translaminar that gets into the plant, works that way, penetrating type material, ahead of rainfall, a rainfast or a sticker might reduce the amount of would slow, not eliminate, but slow the the wash off effect or sometimes a humectant has a, well, if you're going to be applying in a really dry atmosphere, high evaporation conditions, a humectant, which slows the rate of evaporation is a good product to use. So really what's the material you're using? What's the mode of action for the pesticide? The activator, the adjuvant, it really is assists the pesticide. It's not going to make or break the job. Again, less on the label, separate from what the active is in the tank.
And yeah, you were mentioning just a little bit ago some of those main classifications for some of the adjuvants like penetrators and whatnot. You know, growers do really have a number of choices when considering these adjuvants for their tank mixes. What are some of those main classifications of the available adjuvants at the moment, and what are some of their characteristics?
Well, the wetter spreaders reduce the surface tension, and they literally make the droplets run across the surface. They don't make the droplets jump from leaf to leaf, but if you get some material on a leaf, you're going to get much more much more spread from, you know, an organosilicone or there are some non-ionic surfactants that have, well, most of them have some spreading capacity, but the super spreaders, the organosilicones are the best. They're called super spreaders because they do reduce the surface tension to a degree that if you're not careful, you can actually run the product right off the leaf or your target surface, which you don't want to do. So matching your rate, again, back to working with a good PCA, matching your rate to the job and the size of the tree, the amount of surface area that you're trying to cover, that's really important with the spreaders. The penetrators, generally those are oil-based, either petroleum oil, like a crop oil concentrate, or a vegetable oil material, like some of the methylated seed oils. Those are intended to get materials through the waxy surface of the leaf. And that's beneficial in some, you know, you're trying to get the pesticide into the plant, whether it's a miticide like abamectin or an herbicide, get past the protective leaf surface. Those materials, not necessarily great spreaders on their own, but they're intended to penetrate. And that's one of the reasons why the oils are such good penetrators. That's one of the reasons why, say, zinc nutrient or sulfur labels say don't apply with an oil, because you want the zinc or the sulfur on the leaf surface. It's toxic inside the leaf, and the oil will drive that material across the leaf surface. And so that's penetrators. In humectants, sometimes they're oils, other times certain hydrophilic fertilizers are humectants. And stickers are oftentimes resin type materials or materials that resin based plant. There's historically some plant based materials, pine byproducts that literally mix in with the fertilizer, with the pesticide, and keep it from dissolving in rainwater. Which, you know, part of your goal is to, if a rain's coming, you got a fungicide on, you want to redistribute that fungicide, as putting a sticker on it may not be the tool that you want, or using a sticker when you really want to penetrate the material, that would be counterproductive. So those are some of the major ones. I didn't mention, acidifiers also, usually going to be an acid type material. Those are important if the job calls for it.
Franz, my next question for you here, what are the cautions growers should be aware of, you know, if the wrong adjuvant is chosen, and can it damage the crop or the tree?
That's a great question. You have to be very careful. Certain combinations, and it's very difficult. Certain combinations can lead to phyto issues on the leaves, and in a worst case scenario, on a fresh fruit where you're damaging the marketable product. It's very hard to know which combinations do the damage, and because the value of tank mixing, the economic value of tank mixing is so great. Nobody wants to make two applications when they can make one. You end up mixing different active ingredients, different formulations, and perhaps throwing an adjuvant in there too. It's again, that back to that, having working with somebody who's got the experience to steer you to or away from a certain combination is really important. But you can really run into issues with Fido if you're not careful.
If and when it gets to the point where it's affecting marketable fruit, are growers often confusing the damage on marketable fruit with like other things, like other disease, or is it pretty distinguishable from other damage that could happen to marketable fruit?
That's a good question. Sometimes it can be, and that's why, looking at a block that's been sprayed versus a block that hasn't been sprayed, the presence or absence of damage can help you get down, figure out whether it's a Fido issue or not. Where if it's phytotoxic, oftentimes you'll see the spray material may run and pool at the bottom of a fruit or bottom of a leaf. That is indicative of a burn. Whether the burn is due to the product that's applied or the combination of the surfactant and the product is hard to tell. But comparing what you've got in your orchard to other sites and where the damage is on the tissue is part of unfortunately figuring out just what went wrong if there is something there that's either worrisome or worst case potentially costly.
Franz, how can a grower really get the best efficacy out of an adjuvant? Are there practices that they can follow to do that?
Well, first of all, adjuvants are always the adjuvants that go on as a suggested use. They're icing on the cake. They're not specifically stated on the label required for the application. They provide maybe better coverage on the leaf surface, stretching a pesticide, the gallons of spray in the tank across the surface area. But the critical point is that the sprayer has to be calibrated for good coverage, and the coverage has to be delivered, and then the activator can sort of be the icing on the cake or the spreader or the penetrator, get the job done, the job a little bit. But most times the adjuvant, again, if not listed on the label, is the final, the final step that gives you the best possible outcome. But everything else has to be done properly up to that point. The timing has to be right. Application, as I said, to get the job done right. And then the adjuvant helps fill in any possible gaps that got missed. But dial in everything else, and then the adjuvant helps out at the end. But you can't fix bad timing or a bad spray job with an adjuvant. That's shouldn't be an expectation of a grower.
Are there any times at all where a grower just doesn't have to use an adjuvant when they're applying their pesticides, or is it pretty much just a standard practice?
Well, you can get very good results with a well-calibrated sprayer without the use of adjuvants. Most formulated pesticides come with adjuvants in them, different, sometimes a compatibility adjuvant, sometimes they're, affect the surface area, surface tension, things of that nature. Adjuvants don't make or break a spray job. They give that little bit of icing in the cake. So you can get a very good job if you spray carefully. You should be able to get the job done. If you're a little bit short on, say, on liquid, and you're using 100 gallons an acre, and maybe 120, 130 would be perfect. You might be able to, a spreader adjuvant may spread the job, but you have to get the spray on those leaves in order for it to spread on the leaf. It's not going to, as I said before, jump from branch to branch or leaf to leaf. So, so adjuvants are the icing on the cake. And there are times when there are, for instance, at bloom time, when bees are present, particularly when bees are present in the orchard, mm-hmm. adjuvants are designed to spread the material, to get material into plant tissue. They can also get the material into the tissue of bees. So the general rule that we follow and the university recommends is to avoid adjuvants in the spray tank when bees are present in the orchard, particularly we're talking about fungicides that bloom. So those times are particularly important to avoid the adjuvant.
Okay, sounds good. Good sentiment there. Franz, my last question for you here. Do you have any other tips for tank mixing adjuvants in trees and vines? Maybe anything that we haven't covered yet?
Read the label. Work with the experienced PCA. Those are critical. If you're doing this, making this decision yourself, I would spot check the combination of materials with an adjuvant that you're looking for. You can do a jar test, mixing that particular product with a little bit of the adjuvant to see if there's any compatibility issues. There's so many wild cards to be considered. Being cautious with adjuvant selection, where it's just a suggested product, not recommended on the label, is going to pay off, and or at least help you avoid that difficult situation where icing on the cake turns out to be left on the counter overnight. You've got problems. So being careful with those suggested materials is the best way to go.
Well, thank you for all of your suggestions and advice on some of this spray adjuvant selection, and also giving a little clarification on some of the main classifications and those characteristics. We really appreciate you coming on and talking about it today.
Thanks very much, Taylor. I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you.
Of course, as always. This is Taylor with My Ag Life.
Don't let your soils become tainted and unproductive from excess salts. Take care of your crops while caring for your soil. Cation X5 Plus by AgroPlantae is a soil conditioner meant to maximize water penetration by combating harmful salts in the soil, which can injure your crops and bottom line. Cation X5 Plus also corrects sulfur and calcium plant deficiencies. AgroPlantae wants to help you grow your crop. Contact us today to find out more at 559-498-0388 or visit us at www.agroplantae.com.
The California Walnut Board and Commission provides value to the California walnut industry by working together with growers and handlers to advance the industry. Together, the California Walnut Board and Commission are helping to protect, develop, and grow California walnuts domestically and internationally. The California Walnut Board provides funding and strategic direction on walnut production and post-harvest research designed to help support the industry and promote California walnuts. To learn more, visit our website at walnuts.org. Together we grow.
Joining me today is Casey Creamer, President and CEO of California Citrus Mutual.
California Citrus Mutual recently put out a news release highlighting the cost of production for citrus growers. Casey, can we start off with you giving me just an overview of that, please?
Yeah, it started, we did a Naval Orange cost survey just before the pandemic, really trying to communicate out to the membership to how have costs changed over the last several years with labor costs going up, rules and regulations, water costs. So there's lots of, the costs just keep rising for citrus growers. And so we really want to get a good industry average of how things have changed. And so we did that, but then, the pandemic, it just really changed everything. There's been a limited supply of lots of things, transportation issues, containers at the port. You're starting to see fuel prices go really high. And so we just felt like what we had heard from our membership is that these costs are skyrocketing. And so we really wanted to look at it and say, how have they changed since the start of the pandemic? Because we thought they were going to be drastic, but we really wanted to verify that as an industry. And so we took a look at that. We knew what some of the major cost drivers were and try to put something together that was a good industry average. And so we did that.
You mentioned several of the things that are causing price increases, but let's focus in on a couple. And two that are mentioned specifically in the news release that I saw were water and shipping. Tell me about how these two things are affecting the industry.
Yeah, so the shipping costs themselves have just absolutely catapulted. I think we put a number of $12,000 a container. For some, that might be low. It's probably a decent average, but we also know that number is going even higher. And so the cost that we calculated are roughly 380% increase from since prior to the pandemic of what it cost to get a container and do export. But the impacts are much greater than just the costs of the containers, because the backups at the ports have created a log jam and prevented shipments from going out. And so that loss of sales has been tremendously impactful to California citrus growers, not just in the export market, but also in the domestic market, because of trying to move additional product on the domestic market, frankly, at lower prices than what we could get export. So a significant impact to the industry.
And citrus is not one of those crops that can sit around at the ports for a while or take some time with shipping. That needs to be handled very efficiently for citrus.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I would say we are a perishable commodity. We can probably withstand, you know, some delays at the ports, because we can hold for a little while, not like some of the other much more perishable commodities. But it's very important to get it as quickly as possible. I mean, we're going from harvest to through the packing house and on a truck within a day or maybe two at the most. And so it's very important that we have fresh product. And when we're shipping overseas, you know, a lot of places that we send it, it takes 3 weeks to get there, 2.5 to 3.5 weeks to get there. And so the goal is to have the freshest piece of fruit for the consumer so they come back for more. And the delays at the ports, if it's 1 day, 2 days, we were seeing weeks, it affects that end quality. And it's utmost importance that we keep, you know, high quality products in the market.
And then let's talk about water. Now, our agricultural listeners will know this, of course, but we also get a lot of consumer listeners, and it's nice to explain some different things to them as well. When we talk about California and agriculture, drought always comes up. Of course, we are in a drought year. Water is hard this year, but water is also expensive. So how has the cost of water been impacting the citrus industry?
Yeah, so water is a difficult thing to quantify. You've got regions, you've got north, south, east, and west, you've got surface water rights and no surface water rights. Whether you have delivery of surface water even available to you. And so, you know, we try to just look at the spot market for water and take some estimates where something might have cost $300 an acre foot to get by excess water prior to the drought is now ranging from $1,000 to $2,000. And that's even if you can get it at that. I mean, people are willing to bid, you know, $2,000 plus for water, which is completely unsustainable. You will not make a profit if you're paying that much for your surface water per acre foot. And so it's significant. You know, that spot market is big. I mean, we're also seeing cost increases, pumping cost increases. The groundwater table is not, you know, what it used to be. We get lots of reports from growers of wells with diminished capacity, having to drill deeper wells. And then the cost of drilling those wells and the repairs that are skyrocketing as well because of the demand that's out there. So there are significant costs across the board, and water is a major driver, and probably a major driver of what the cultural costs that we're estimating to be up on average 19% across the board.
And then to put a dollar amount on it, when we talk about 19%, the dollar amount I saw was an average of, I believe it was $1,000 per acre, just in an increase of business expenses. Is that right?
Yeah, it just our industry average is probably a little bit under 1,000, but 1,000 is kind of like that number. If it was 984 or something like that, but on average, I definitely there's people that the cost impacts, especially on water, with, you know, if they're in a dire situation, are going to be much higher than that. But on average for the industry, probably somewhere right around $1,000 an acre. And that's nothing to sneeze at. That's significant. And that's just an increase. So,
yeah. And that is significant. And there's a lot of romanticism around farming where we're talking about growing food for people and nourishing people. But bottom line, every farm is also a business. And business decisions have to be made. And the businesses have to keep running if we're going to continue providing, you know, food and nutritious citrus and things to people. When we're talking about these business decisions now, as in any industry, when your costs increase so substantially, it is hard to keep these businesses surviving. What can farmers do to keep their businesses going so that we can continue to have California grown fresh fruits and vegetables? What can be done?
Yeah, the number one thing that I would say to a grower dealing with this situation right now is they have to understand their own costs and how they are changing, because this is an industry average that we're talking about, and really the rate of change, I'm pretty certain probably the rate of change is probably pretty consistent, but everybody sort of sits in a different place, whether you have water rights, what your particular you're growing, but everybody needs to really take a hard look at their costs and have a conversation with their packing houses and marketers. Are the varieties that I'm growing, the varieties that I'm planting, gonna get the return that's necessary to stay in business? And so that's the first thing. We need to have people who are on top of that. And for a large part, I think the industry is, but I think that the rate of change is happening, and it's just a refocus and just make sure that they can. And then second, we've got to work together to change the direction, the policies that are affecting these changes. And look, I'd love to be able to give all of our growers answers on the water situation yesterday. I want to give them answers on the labor situation costs yesterday. But the reality is that we didn't get here overnight on all of these issues. These were, you know, just add-ons, continual issues. And we need to have a unified, cohesive effort, strong effort to peel these things back, to make things better than what they would have been, to protect the future of the industry as well. And so, you know, it's real easy to with the frustration that's out there right now, to look at things and give up. And I don't know any other way but to keep on fighting and keep on working. And so I just, you know, stay on top of things, stay informed, communicate with us, communicate with other growers, and let's stick together and do everything we can to better the situation now and for tomorrow.
Then my last question would be for you, how do you see this trickling down to the consumer? Do you think consumers will see a difference in prices?
I think it has to. California grows 90% of the fresh citrus available in the United States, and that has to be passed on to consumers, unfortunately. And so a lot of times policymakers will it's okay to pass it on to the grower. But when things start to get to the voter, it's a little different story. But voters and consumers are going to pay more for California citrus. And so this directly impacts us, but it directly impacts every consumer here in the United States. And so we just need to take a careful look at all of our policies so that we can, you know, keep growers profitable and keep food affordable.
That's our show for today. If there's a topic you'd like to hear about, send me an email to sabrina@myaglife.com. This is the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson. From the JCS Marketing Team, thanks for listening.